Tzoraim Tovim, everybody. Welcome, Canada, the United States, Israel, wherever you may be, to part two, I guess, the second of three shiurim we'll be having today. And I want to thank Arnie and Faye Niederhofer, who are sponsoring our day of learning today. Schut should have a refuah shlema for everybody. Everybody should be well. And I wanted to thank you and pleasure to welcome back Shuli, who gave a four-part series finished, I don't know, a few weeks ago. And we're looking forward to seeing in the future. Very much enjoyable. And it's a pleasure to welcome her back to give a talk on Hanukkah and how the Cheshmonaim changed Yerushalayim and Judaism, and always her hands-on approach. And Shuli teaches at Pardes Matan, at Derecheha, with the Bible in hand and archaeology, you know, the tools of both, and of course now in the situation that's all on Zoom, but those who were with us before know how the clarity of the pictures and the description, you almost feel like you're there. So Bakasha, we're looking to go back a couple thousand years and relive how the Cheshmonaim lived in the year 168 or so BCE. Bakasha Shuli, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. And thank you for inviting me on very short notice. So hi, everybody. Happy Hanukkah. So nice to see so many familiar names and faces, mostly names. I'm not seeing so many faces. Like we've done in the past, or if you haven't been here before, questions that you have, I am so happy to answer, but I'm not going to answer during the lecture. So you can either write them in the chat or ask them at the end. For some reason, I'm not hearing so great. So probably writing them in the chat is the best option. And without further ado, I am going to share my screen and we are going to start telling the story of Hanukkah, but a particular element of the story of Hanukkah. Okay, so my glorious brothers, this is a crowd that probably recognizes where the quote comes from, right? The novel by Howard Fast. Not so many people know it anymore, but it was a big hit at the time. And I want to start by saying that at least in the diaspora, less so in Israel, although in Israel it's also a little bit, Hanukkah is, on the one hand, it's the most misunderstood of all the holidays, but I will argue that it is one of the most important holidays. What do I mean by the most misunderstood? Certainly in North America, a lot of people, maybe not in the Orthodox world, but in the larger world, in the non-Jewish world, think of Hanukkah as the Jewish Christmas, right? You get presents every night and you have lights, just like the Christmas lights. And even in, you know, there was a recent piece in the forewords about how the New York Times opinion pieces on Hanukkah for the last 10 years have all been either Hanukkah is like a baby holiday or it's hypocritical or nobody takes Hanukkah seriously. Intellectually. Okay. On the other hand, I would argue that after Pesach, which of course is the most important Jewish holiday, Hanukkah is the second most important Jewish holiday, because without Hanukkah, we would not be here. And without Judaism, there would be no Christianity and there would be no Islam. Monotheism would have disappeared from the world. And both of these things, the fact that Hanukkah is so misunderstood and the fact that Hanukkah is so important, can be explained with one word, and that word is assimilation. Right? Without the Maccabees revolting against Hellenism, without their refusal to assimilate, we would have melted away into the world and into Greek culture. And ironically, today, Hanukkah, because of the powers and the forces of assimilation, has become a very misunderstood holiday. So we're going to try to go back in time and understand the origins of Hanukkah and understand why it was such a huge event, what happened. So a quick timeline, in case you don't remember your Second Temple period so well, and if you do, you can use this time to make yourself a cup of coffee. Jews return to Judea very soon, right? The Jews are exiled by the Babylonians. The temple is destroyed in 586 BCE. All these dates here, of course, are BCE. But less than 50 years later, the Jews come back. The Babylonians have been conquered by the Persians. Cyrus' very famous decree allows the Jews to come back. Only a small percentage of them, by the way, come back, because it's not so terrible living there in Babylonia. But the Jews return. They begin to rebuild the temple. The Persians rule in Judea. A little less than 200 years later, A little more than 200 years later, you have a very, very significant event, the one that's going to be the engine of our whole story. And that is Alexander the Great, who conquers, of course, not just Judea, but much of the known world, brings it under Greek control, and brings not only Greek military might and political systems, but the cultures of Hellenism. Okay, now it takes another 150 years or so until we have the story of Hanukkah. We don't know a lot about that time period, by the way, but that's a story for another class. 167, Antiochus IV, who's known as Antiochus Epiphanus or Epimanus by the Jews, the crazy one, enacts decrees against Judaism, desecrates the temple. We have the revolt of Matityahu and his sons, who are known as the Maccabees. 3 years later, Judah the Maccabee defeats the Greeks, but it's not really the end of the story. We think of it as the end of the story. It really takes another good 20 years till the Greeks are completely defeated. But we have the beginning of 100 solid years of Hasmonean sovereignty, which essentially up until 1948, except for a very, very brief blip of the Bar Kokhba period, this is the last time that Jews are sovereign in the land of Israel. So it's a very significant thing. 164 to 63, Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. The Hasmonean kingdom expands, grows, converts people. All of this expansion and power comes to an abrupt end in the year 63, when there is a civil war between two contenders for the Hasmonean throne, two brothers, in fact. And we're over here. Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II doing something extremely unwise, calling in a larger power to solve the problems between them. This larger power, of course, is Rome. And once the Romans are invited, they don't exactly go home. And that begins about 500 years of Roman rule in the land of Israel. But that's a separate story. And I added in here at the end the story of Herod, because Herod is also, as we're going to see, kind of an unintended consequence of the story of Hanukkah. Herod's father, Antipater, is appointed procurator, like a governor, by Julius Caesar. Matityahu Antigonus, the final Hashmonai king, conquers Jerusalem with the help of the Parthians. Herod flees, but he comes back. He's victorious. He gets the Romans on his side, and he begins his rule in 37 BCE. And that's where we're going to stop our timeline. Of course, there is more. But let's go back to Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander the Great is an extraordinary, it's one of the extraordinary military conquest stories in human history, equaled perhaps by Muhammad coming out of Arabia and also in an incredibly short time, conquering huge swaths of territory. Alexander the Great comes from Macedon, from Greece. At 20 years old, he becomes king. 20 years old, he has a 10-year military campaign where he creates a kingdom. We're going to see a map in a second, that extends from Greece through North Africa, all the way to India. It's incredible, okay? Now, this huge empire, like we said, doesn't bring just Greek military might. It brings Greek ideas. Alexander is a student of Aristotle, right? He knows Greek philosophy. He brings Greek ideas with him. Many cities that are built. He dies very abruptly at age 33. Maybe poisoned, maybe sick, we don't really know, but he really dies in his prime. And he's an interesting character because Judaism and Jewish texts don't look at Alexander negatively, despite the fact that he's the one who kind of starts this whole ball rolling. But Alexander is a pretty positive figure in Jewish texts, and there are even Jews who were named Alexander throughout history, named after Alexander the Great. And I'm sure some of us here know Alexanders. And when you look at the stories about Alexander in the Jewish texts, they're very interesting, right? One of them, the most famous one, is about how Alexander is informed by the Samaritans, right? Samaritans are this Jewish sect, breakaway sect, that inform against the Jews, tell Alexander the Jews are going to revolt against him. He comes to attack Jerusalem. He's camped at Antipatris, which is a place by Rosh Ha'ayin near Petah Tikva of today. And as he is getting ready to march on Jerusalem, who comes to greet him? The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, Shimon HaTzadik, wearing his, of course, his flowing white robes with a whole entourage of Kohanim. And when they come up to Alexander and his camp, Alexander gets off his horse and bows down in front of Shimon HaTzadik. And his soldiers are astonished. And they say, what are you doing? Why are you bowing to this Jew? And he says, when I go to battle, it is his face that I see. Right? And this is this powerful story in the Gemara and Yoma, where Alexander, of course, doesn't march on Jerusalem. Instead, he attacks the Samaritans and he destroys their temple on Har Gerizim. But it's very interesting where here we have the quintessential Greek who bows to the power of the Jewish God and his Kohanim and his priests. Other stories we have in the Gemara are a little less complimentary. They're kind of poking fun, perhaps not at Alexander, but at Greek wisdom, right? He's very wise, but he's not really very wise. He answers all these questions. He ends up in an island of powerful women, the Amazons, right? Was Gal Gadot there? I don't know. And they ask him all kinds of questions, and his philosophy is not so adequate, right? And ultimately, he is shown up as being very, very greedy, but he's not a negative character. So that's an interesting thing. Now here's the range of his kingdom, right? Macedon is all the way over here in the west. That's where he comes from and conquers all the way through the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia, all the way out to India. He doesn't hold on, his successors don't hold on to all of it, but he does conquer all of this, including Egypt and including, of course, Judea, the land of Israel. Now, after he dies, his inheritors fight over what's left, right? And for our purposes, what's important, we're not going to talk about India, but we're going to talk about our area, where we have basically two major dynasties. In Egypt, we have the Ptolemies with a P. Okay. In Syria, we have the Seleucids. Okay. Up until the year 200 before the Common Era, the Ptolemies, it's a silent P, controlled Judea. And then in 200, the Seleucids take over. And of course, Antiochus is a Seleucid, and that's where the whole story begins. Okay. But as I said, the most important part of the story is not the story of the conquest, because Judea has been conquered over and over again. The story is the cultural conquest. Okay, what is Hellenism? Hellenism originally meant somebody who speaks Greek. And what happens is a fascinating phenomenon. Okay, you have Greek soldiers who spread out to all these newly acquired lands. And as soldiers often do, they marry the local women. Okay, they establish cities, or they move into the cities and give them Greek characteristics. And what develops is this very interesting hybrid where the language of everybody is Greek, right? Everybody speaks Greek. Greek is the universal language, okay? The culture becomes a mixture, right? You have local gods, you have Greek gods, you have intermarriage, you have this really interesting mix, but a very dominant form of Greek culture. And all these locals, right, what used to be called Philistines or Phoenicians or Edomites, they all become Hellenists. And the reason I brought you this picture is this is a picture of a burial cave complex from Beit Guvrin in Israel, right, in not so far from Beit Shemesh. And we know a lot about the family whose burial cave this is, because there's an inscription that says that this is the burial cave of Apollophanus, the leader of the Sidonians at Maresha. Who are Sidonians? From Sidon, the Phoenicians from Lebanon. They moved down the coast. They settled in various places. They moved into this Edomite city, what had been a Jewish city. It became ruled by the Edomites, by Esav, right? And they move in. And they establish themselves there. And Apollophanus, who's a very wealthy guy, makes a family tomb. But here we go. This is a Sidonian, meaning what is his religion? What's his ethnicity? Let's put it that way. He's a Canaanite. Phoenicians are Canaanites. His name is Greek, Apollophanus. The writing in the tomb is Greek. Everything is Greek. But the style of burial is very Eretz Israel. This is how the Jews and non-Jews buried in the land of Israel. And this is his style. He's not Jewish, but he's a Sidonian who basically takes some elements of his culture, but takes on a great amount of Greek culture. Now, one of the great things in this cave is you can see there are these incredible paintings, which when the cave was discovered about 100 years ago, the paintings were there. They were intact. These are 2,200-year-old paintings. They were vandalized by the local Arabs who didn't like imagery. But fortunately, somebody had sketched them and taken pictures of them. And they, when the national park was opened, they redid the paintings. And take a look at who is guarding the entrance to the cave. If you or your children are Harry Potter readers, right, you may recognize Fluffy otherwise known as Cerberus, right? Cerberus, the three-headed dog who guards the gates to Hades. Right? And that's what Apollophanes chooses to put in his tomb. So everybody is becoming a Hellenist, and the cities themselves as well, right? We have two cities, which you may recognize by other names. Ptolemais here on the left is Akko. Joppa is Jaffa. Of course, the Greeks move into the cities on the coast because those were always the Gentile cities. Right? And again, they bring their material culture, the market, the agora, paved streets, a gymnasium for sports. You have Greek traders, you have Greek coins, the language is Greek. But the people are citizens of the government, right? This is not a Semitic idea at all. And you also have Greek philosophical ideas and literary ideas. And I'll bring you another city, okay, Scythopolis, right? A polis, of course, is a city in Greek, and the polis has certain rules and citizens have certain rights. Scythopolis is better known to us as Beit Sha'an, right? Very ancient city that was up on the top of the tell, but the Greeks come and expand it to the bottom, and the Romans come and expand it even more, and they turn it into a completely Greek city with a pagan temple at the top of the hill, with all kinds of statues and fountains and a big main street, right? And paving, right? That's not, definitely not something that we find paved streets in the ancient Israelite towns. And they create something new. Now, Jews are also living in these cities. Often they're the minority. This is not Jerusalem, but they're also living in these cities, and they're also part of this story. And that's where we get to this very interesting question. When many of us learned the story of Hanukkah when we were younger, okay, what did we learn? Good Jews, bad Greeks, big fight, good Jews win. As we grew older, we learned that the story is a lot more complicated than that. And along with the good Jews, let's not be too judgmental, we don't have bad Jews, we have Jews who like Hellenism. Now, some of them are what we'll call extreme Hellenizers, meaning they like this culture. It's modern, it's new, or maybe they don't like it. They can take it or leave it, but it'll get you ahead politically. It'll get you ahead socially, right? Why do Jews assimilate? Because it gets them to a better place in society. For whatever reason, there are many Jews who are very attracted by this way of life. Okay, and those are what we'll call extreme Hellenists. But, and that's what I brought this picture on a vase of course, the sportsmen, the runners were, of course, running naked, of course, not circumcised, right? That's a very, very extreme form of Hellenism. But you have a whole spectrum, a very broad spectrum. And many Jews, wittingly or unwittingly, adopt Greek ideas, Greek philosophy, Greek literary forms. The rabbis do as well. And in fact, the rabbis express this, right? Beautiful phrase. They take the blessing that Noah gives to two of his sons, Yaft Elokim li Yefet, v'yishkon ba'ohalei shein. God will make Yefet beautiful. Who's Yefet? The ancestor of Yavan, of the Greeks. But he will dwell in the tents of Shem. And the rabbis took this idea and they said, take the beauty of Yefet, but put into it the content of Shem, meaning the godly content. And they took philosophical ideas like free will and fate and providence. They took literary devices like codes or wisdom literature. They took Greek languages. They took the Greek language, Greek words. They took political or social institutions like the Sanhedrin, and they filled these vessels with Jewish content. And the struggle between the extreme Hellenizers and the moderate Hellenizers is a very interesting one. Now, I brought you a picture here on the right. This is not from our time period. It's from a little later. It's from the late first century before the Common Era. This is in the Herodian Quarter in Jerusalem, very wealthy, beautiful houses of Kohanim. And this is a living room, or what's known as a triclinium, triclinium, reclining. Because how did people sit, the wealthy people? They had couches where they lay down, and they had little tables next to them, and that was how they ate. Do we do that? Yes, we do. We do it at the Seder, okay? And the Seder is the perfect example of this. The Seder is taking a very formal Greek meal called a symposium, which involves courses and questions and discussion and dessert at the end, which is called afikoman, Okay. And we take that Greek form and we fill it up with Jewish content. And we even subvert the Greek form, because what do we say? Ein maftirim achara Pesach afikoman. We don't eat anything after the afikoman. What did they really do in the symposium? After the afikoman, after the dessert, that's when the wine starts flowing and all the partying begins. We don't do that. Well, maybe in some houses they do. But this idea of taking from the Hellenistic world is universal. The question is, how much? And we're going to see what's going on. Before we get to that, just have a great side story. Okay. A lot of what we know about the story of Hanukkah comes from a book that is called one of the Sfarim Chitzoniim, a book that doesn't make it into our Tanakh, a few books actually called the Books of Maccabees. Okay. But they give us a lot of historical knowledge about the story. And one of the stories we get in the second book of Maccabees is about a fellow named Heliodorus, okay, who is coming as the ambassador of the king Seleucus IV. He's the immediate predecessor of Antiochus. And he is sent by Seleucus IV to Jerusalem because the king knows that the temple has a lot of treasure. And he's sent to collect this treasure. And of course, what happens, but just as Heliodorus was arriving at the treasury with his bodyguard, the Lord of Spirits and all authority produced an apparition so great that those that had been bold enough to accompany Heliodorus were panic-stricken at God's power and fainted away in terror. Okay, so all these angels appear and they beat him up, and that's it. And he doesn't take any treasure. Great story. What does it have to do with reality? So here's where we get to the picture on the left, with some people who've been to the Israel Museum many times may recognize. This has been in the Israel Museum for about at least 10 years. It's called the Heliodorus Stela, which is a large monumental inscription, which has actually got a few parts. In one part, it talks about Seleucus, the king, appointing someone named Olympiodorus to be in charge of the temples in his region, i.e. to do whatever he wants there. And then Heliodorus, our friend from here, shows up to make sure that these decrees are enacted. So here you have an inscription from the time period that we're talking about, essentially another version, kind of more Greek-centric version of the story that we have in the Book of Maccabees. But the discovery of this inscription is an even better story, okay? The inscription, as you can see, is in a number of different parts, right? The top part was bought on the antiquities market by Michael Steinhardt. Michael Steinhardt, you know, the founder of Birthright, very wealthy guy. And he bought it on the antiquities market. But when you buy something on the antiquities market, it doesn't have, the technical term is provenance. We don't know where it came from. Okay. But still important Greek inscription. And he lends it to the Israel Museum. A few years later, in the archaeological digs that are done by volunteers in Beit Guvrin, it's called Dig for a Day. Some people here may have done it. They discover three pieces of a Greek inscription. And the archaeologist who works there, Ian Stern, he had a very sharp eye. And he said, you know, this sounds a lot like, it sounds familiar. Maybe there's something in the Israel Museum warehouse that fits. And you can see it fits perfectly, right? It fits perfectly. And what presumably happened is a few years earlier, antiquities robbers had broken into the cave, stolen the first half, couldn't get away with everything. And now we know where the second half, where this came from. It came from the caves of Beit Guvrin, which makes sense, a very Hellenized city, Maresha. And of course, that's where the king is going to put up his proclamation. Okay, but now we get to Antiochus. Okay, Antiochus's father, Antiochus III, is actually rather tolerant of Jews. And it's important to understand in general that rulers were tolerant of Jews. We are so used to anti-Semitism and decrees and gzerot, but this was not the way of the ancient world. Okay, Jews were conquered, they were exiled, but there wasn't really such a sense of religious persecution. Paganism is very tolerant. You have your religion, I have my religion, I think you're crazy, but do whatever you want. Antiochus is the first one who comes along and decrees religiously against the Jews. That's a very unusual thing. So why does he do this? That's an excellent question. We don't really know, but we know that he marches on Jerusalem. He conquers the city. He desecrates the temple. He's helped along by these extreme Hellenizers, as we're going to see from the Book of Maccabees. There's a whole core of them, even in the temple, and the Kohen Gadol is an extreme Hellenizer. And he probably assumes that everybody's going to follow along because Hellenism is the thing, right? So here's a coin with Antiochus's face on it. Here are some of his arrowheads. that were discovered in Jerusalem. Just one more thing before we get to the actual decrees. Antiochus comes, and according to the book of Maccabees and according to Josephus later, he builds a large fortress called the Acra, or the Chakra in Hebrew. Where is this fortress? This is a question that archaeologists have been trying to answer for decades. We still don't really have an answer. Lots of different suggestions. One suggestion was by the southern wall here, by the Hulda Gates. Further down, there's an earlier Second Temple period structure. Nobody really holds by that so much anymore. A few years ago, there was a discovery in the Givati parking lot. Some people may remember in the old days, there was actually a parking lot across from the city of David. Today, it's been an archaeological site for about 15 years, an amazing site. And 5 years ago, archaeologists discovered, it's the picture on the right here, the remains of walls and a ramp leading up to a fortress and those arrowheads that we saw before, which are have Antiochus's symbol on them. And they said, maybe this is the Chakra. Maybe this is really it. But it's got issues. Topographically, it doesn't make sense. It's very low down. And bottom line, we don't really know. We do know that when Shimon HaMaccabee conquers Jerusalem completely, he takes apart, he destroys the Acra. So whatever we're going to find, we're not going to find anything very big. Now, here's where the story comes to a head. And take a look at how the Book of Maccabees tells it. The Book of Maccabees also is very aware that we have not only an external enemy, but an internal enemy. In those days went out of Israel wicked men who persuaded many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the heathen that are round about us. For since we departed from them, we have had much sorrow out of Israel. These are Jews. So this device pleased them well. And certain of the people were so forward herein that they went to the king, who gave them a license to do after the ordinances of the heathen. Okay, so they get support from the king, whereupon they built a place of exercise at Jerusalem, a gymnasium in Jerusalem, according to the customs of heathens, and made themselves uncircumcised, right? They were moshech their milah. They made it look like they weren't circumcised and forsook the holy covenant and joined themselves to the heathen and were sold to do mischief. That's the beginning of the book of Maccabees, that this is something Jewish. And only then, later in the chapter, do we hear about Antiochus. Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and everyone should leave his laws. So all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. Also fascinating, right? What does he want? Why does he want to do this? Not because he hates the Jews, but because we should all be one people. Progress, beautiful, right? Imagine a world where everything is one, where there are no more nations. Everybody is a Hellenist. Also, many of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath, right? And it goes on to tell us about the decrees. And this is, like I said, the first time we really hear about gzeirot, about religious decrees. No sacrifices, no Shabbat. No circumcision. Everything is turned upside down and the temple is desecrated. Now, very interesting question. What would have happened if Antiochus had not come along, right? Would the internal battle between the Jews have developed into a civil war? We really don't know, right? Or would the extreme Hellenizers perhaps have won? Whatever happened, whatever would have happened, Antiochus did not expect a popular revolt. And yet that is exactly what happens, led by Matityahu, a Kohen, and his sons. Okay, so let's read the story and then we'll talk about where is Modi'in. In the meanwhile, the king's officers, such as compelled the people to revolt, came into the city Modi'in to make them sacrifice, right? They went around to various towns and they said, sacrifice to idols. And when many of Israel came upon them, Matityahu also and his sons came together. Now Matityahu clearly was a respected person in the town. He's a Kohen, he's from an important family. And the king's officers want him to be an example, right? We've had this throughout Jewish history. If the leader of the Jews will convert, will bow to the idol, will do whatever needs to be done, then everybody's going to follow. And they said, thou art a ruler and an honorable and great man in the city, strengthened with sons and brethren. Therefore, come you first and fulfill the king's commandment, like all the heathen have done and the men of Judah also, and such as remain in Jerusalem. And you and your house will be in the number of the king's friends. It'll be good for you if you do this. And you and your children will be honored with silver and gold and many rewards. And here is Matityahu, one of those. There are just certain turning points in history, and this is one of them. Matityahu answered and spoke with a loud voice. Though all the nations that are under the king's dominion obey him and fall away everyone from the religion of their fathers and give consent to his commandments, yet will I and my sons and my brothers walk in the covenant of our fathers. And that's it. That's it. We will not be swept away by the tide of Hellenism. And Matityahu making that speech, he makes it for his family, but many people are stirred to action by that speech and they start to push back against the extreme Hellenism. Now, where is Modiin? Excellent question, right? We all know where modern Modiin is. Basically halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, big, beautiful modern city built about 20, 25 years ago. Is it where ancient Modiin is? So we have a few possibilities. We have no great answers, okay? Not so far from modern Modiin is an Arab town called Al-Madya. That's the picture you see here on the right. Aside from the fact that Madya and Modiin sound the same, we don't have any great proof that this is Modiin. Meaning, why do we not have any proof? Because no one's ever done excavations there. So there are those who suggest that this is Modiin, but we have no proof for it. In modern Modiin itself, there are two archaeological sites, and we've actually found archaeological sites there because it's a city that was essentially built from the ground up. It's a totally modern city. So while they were building, they discovered archaeological sites. One is in the center of the town. It's called Givat Titura, and there they found burial caves and they found a mikvah, but no real houses, nothing that would indicate a real city. And the truth is, we don't know if Modiin was a city. We know it was a well-known place, right? The Gemara talks about Modiin as the place where if you are further than Modiin, then and you can't come to Yerushalayim for Pesach, then you are Biderech Rechoka. You're far enough away that you can do that second Pesach, Pesach Sheni. So people knew where Modiin was, but it doesn't mean it was a metropolis, right? The other site is the picture that you see here on the left, and that's a site on the edge of Modiin called Umm el-Ubdan. And this is where they discovered burial caves, coins from the time of Antiochus, so the timing is right, and an ancient synagogue, right? And that's what you're seeing in the picture here. So Umdan really might be a contender for ancient Modiin. So far, nobody has found the welcome to Modiin sign, but that's a very good possibility. Now, the battles begin. Matityahu's speech is very nice, but it has to be followed up by actions. Matityahu dies soon afterwards, and his sons, led of course by Judah, begin the battles. A great and easy way to remember the way the battles work, this was taught to me many years ago by tour guide Paris excellence Aryeh Rotenberg, is to think of a Chanukiah, right? We have a Chanukiah. What is a Chanukiah? It's got eight branches. If it's your classic Chanukiah, it's got the shamash sticking up in the middle, okay? How does that help us? Four battles take place, okay, before they go and purify the temple. And after they purify the temple, there's another four battles. Okay, so we have these four preliminary battles. We have the shamash in the middle, which is going to the temple, but then the story is not over and the battles continue. Where are these battles? We're only going to take a look in depth at one of them, but still nice to have a basic idea what we're talking about. Okay, one is in the area of the Shomron near what we call Male Livona. One is on the very important road called Ma'ale Beit Horon, right, that goes down to the valley. One takes place in the Ayalon Valley at a place called Emmaus, right? One takes place in Beit Sur, between Gush Etzion and Hebron of today and Karmei Tzur of today, okay? That's the fourth battle. After that, Judah and his men go up to Jerusalem, but the battles continue after that. You have a battle in Beit Zachariah. That's where the brother Elazar charges the elephant and is killed. And that's why there's a Yishuv called Elazar right there. Okay. We have a battle in Kfar Shalem, which is not far from Gibeon, right? Not far from Jerusalem. We have one in, again, near Beit Hovron in Chabasha. And then we have the final one in El Asa, near Mount Baal Chatzor, and that's where Judah is killed in battle, okay? So those are our, just a basic understanding of the battles. We could do a whole class just on the battles, but we just want to have a basic understanding of what happened. But we are going to take a look at one of those battles, and that is the third one, okay? Now, before they go into battle, the first two are relatively successful, but then the Greeks bring more soldiers, more men. They're very powerful, and the Jews are beginning to despair. And Judah understands that he has to do something to bring up morale. So what does he do? He goes to a place that was the place where Jews would gather, right, in ancient times to repent, to pray, and to go out to battle. What is that place? That place is called Mitzpah. And if you look in the book of Judges, if you look in the book of Samuel, especially the book of Samuel, Samuel gathers the people together there. They repent. They go out to battle against the Philistines. It's also the place where King Saul is crowned. Very, very important place. Listen to what it says in the book of Maccabees, and then we'll talk about where it is. Now, Jerusalem lay void as a wilderness. There was none of her children that went in or out. The sanctuary was trodden down. Aliens kept the stronghold. The heathen had their habitation in that place, and joy was taken from Jacob. The pipe with the harp ceased. Wherefore, the Israelites assembled themselves together and came to Mitzpah, over against Jerusalem, right? Opposite Jerusalem. For Mitzpah was the place where they prayed aforetime in Israel, and they fasted and put on sackcloth and cast ashes upon their head and rent their clothes, right? They do all these classic forms of repentance, and then Judah leads them out to battle. Where is Mitzpah? So some people may recognize the site in this picture. It is well known as Nebi Samuel. It's slightly to the north of Jerusalem. If you drive out of the Ramot neighborhood of Jerusalem, you get very quickly to Nebi Samuel. Beautiful, beautiful site, amazing views. Nebi Samuel, the grave of Samuel, Kever Shmuel HaNavi, right? That's what people have thought this was since about the time, a little bit after the Crusaders, who are the guys who build a lot of the stuff around here, okay? Christians originally come up with the idea, Jews follow. A lot of people were very skeptical because there were no biblical era remains that were found here. The Crusaders built very massively. The Ottoman Turks after them come along and build the mosque, but there was nothing biblical that was found here until about 30 years ago when the Israel Antiquities Authority decided to excavate in this part of the site, which hadn't been touched by the Crusaders. And what did they find? They found a whole intact neighborhood of houses that goes back to pre-Hanukkah times, to Hellenistic times, third, second century of before the Common Era. That's already fascinating. But underneath that, in the fill of the houses, they found all kinds of artifacts that go back to First Temple times, meaning this is a biblical site. And if it is a biblical site, it's much more likely that it's not Ramah, right, Shmuel's hometown, but Mitzpah. Why? Because what does Mitzpah mean? It means litzpot, to look out and overlook. Mitzpah is the tallest hill in the area of Binyamin, well, one of the tallest. It's about 900 meters high. It is clearly over against Jerusalem. You are looking at Jerusalem when you are up there. You have an incredible view. Makes a lot of sense that this is the place where Judah gathers his men to pray in order to conquer Jerusalem. Now, at the same time, the Greeks are in a place called Emmaus. Emmaus is about, if you drive, about 20, 25 minutes away. Okay, today we call it Park Canada. It's right near Latrun, down in the valley, in the Ayalon Valley, where Joshua has an important battle centuries before. It becomes an important Roman city. It's a city that's well known for its hot springs and its beautiful waters. And this is a Roman era bathhouse that was discovered there. And the Greeks are down in Emmaus. And here's where you get this very strange story. Okay, the Greek general in Emmaus decides that he's going to take a small group of his men and he's going to sneak uphill towards Mitzpah to surprise Judah. At the same time, Judah takes all his men and sneaks downhill to Emmaus. And Emmaus has been left because they assume that, you know, they're going to rout the Jews. Emmaus has been basically left unguarded. Judah and his men conquer. They rout the Greeks. The Greeks run off into the countryside, and it's a great victory for the Maccabees. So that's the story of Emmaus. Now, after that fourth battle, okay, my mother-in-law is watching, so she recognizes who's in the picture. And this, of course, is my son, who just turned bar mitzvah. He was my model for this picture. This is right near my house. It's called Derech Avot, the Path of the Patriarchs. Judah is coming from the area near Hebron. He's going up to Jerusalem. What's the road you take? There's only one road that you take from Hebron to Jerusalem, and it's called Derech Avot, the Path of the Patriarchs. And along that path is an ancient mikveh. Now, it's a second temple period mikveh. It's the most beautiful mikveh that's been discovered yet in the land of Israel, ancient mikveh. It's unclear if it was around in the time of the Maccabees or not. It might be a little bit later, but it might be this time as well. We can't really tell with something like this. And if it is, it's a fascinating suggestion that Judah and his men go to the mikveh on their way to Jerusalem, right? They're warriors. They've been in battle. They are very clearly impure, and they have to go to the mikvah before they go to Jerusalem to purify the temple. They walk on Derech Ha'avot. Do they visit this mikvah? Perhaps, right? Perhaps. They come to Jerusalem. They purify the temple. And here's where we get to the very interesting divergence in the story of why we have the story of Hanukkah, why we have the holiday of Hanukkah. Right? Now, very famously, and I'm guessing that at least one person in Torah in Motion, Shiurim, this week has talked about this, right? The rabbis don't talk about the battle. They talk about the miracle of the oil. The Maccabees, the book of Maccabees, doesn't talk about the miracle of the oil. We have two different stories. And it's a very interesting question why each one doesn't talk about each one, but they give two stories. The Gemara in Shabbat talks about the miracle of the oil. What is Hanukkah, right? And again, fascinating why Hanukkah gets less than a page in the Gemara, whereas Purim gets an entire tractate. But that is not our question today, right? But on the 25th of Kislev, the days of Hanukkah are 8. The Greeks defiled all the oil. The Chashmonaim came and found only one cruse of oil. It lasted for 8 days. The sages instituted these days and made them holidays. Okay, that's the story of Hanukkah in the Gemara. Miracle of oil. Rabbis institute a holiday. Story of Hanukkah in the book of Maccabees. The 5th and 20th day of the 9th month, which is the month Kislev, I'm reading in the second part of the page here, they rose up in the morning and offered sacrifice at the time and the day the heathen had profaned it. So here's the fascinating thing. Yehudah and his men do not appear in Jerusalem on the 25th of Kislev. They've definitely come earlier. Okay? The suggestion is they come about a month earlier. They deliberately choose the 25th of Kislev to dedicate the temple for two reasons. Reason number one, as it says here, it's the time and the day the heathen had profaned it, presumably a year earlier, right? Or 2 years earlier, the Greeks had come in on that day. But another reason, which is not written here, but if you know your Tanakh, you flip back to the book of Haggai. And in the book of Haggai, right, Haggai is taking place at a time when the Jews have begun to rebuild the second temple. They stop work because the Persian king Darius doesn't allow them to work, and then he allows them to start again. And when do they start again? On the 25th of Kislev. So it's a perfect day for a dedication, a rededication of the Mikdash. And then they keep it for 8 days. It doesn't say here why. Another suggestion from another book is that they miss the holiday of Sukkot, which of course is the other holiday that's 8 days long. And that's why they keep Hanukkah for 8 days. Now, the two stories don't have to contradict each other, but they definitely are very different approaches. Again, notice who makes the holiday in the Gemara? The sages. Who makes the holiday in the book of Maccabees? Judas and his brethren and the whole congregation of Israel. It's very democratic. It's very Greek, ironically. Okay. Everybody chooses together to make this holiday. So two versions of the story. And again, I think the whole Hellenism story is at work here. But the menorah is definitely very important to the Maccabees. This picture on the left is from a coin from the very last Chashmonai king, Matityahu Antigonus, and the 10 agorot coin in modern Israel is based on it. And of course, it's a beautiful menorah. Just a word about the olive oil, right? We talk about the olive oil that was pure, that was untouched, not made impure by the Greeks. It's not only that the Greeks impurified the oil that was there. That's not the word I want, but you know what I mean. Okay. But actually making the oil has to be made in purity. You have to go to the mikvah before you make the oil, right? And here you have an oil press from our same Edomite town of Maresha. Right, it's a very nice oil press. You have the baskets with the oil under here. You have the heavy weights to crush out the oil. But look what's in the middle. You have a nice little altar with a niche for an idol. And when you make your oil, you pour out a little bit to the idol. So you could make extremely impure oil, right? There's shemen nesach, not only yayin nesach, right? Once the Greeks are defeated and the Jews come back to Jerusalem, they get rid of the symbols of Greek power. They destroy the Acra. And then we have two sites which are a little bit strange until you understand this idea of getting rid of the symbols of Greek power. The picture on the left is a site called Ramat Rachel in southern Jerusalem. It's just a beautiful, it used to be a kibbutz. Now it's just a neighborhood in southern Jerusalem and a hotel. But there's an archaeological site there. We used to think it was the palaces of Judean kings. Today, the archaeologists who have dug there more recently are inclined to think that this is where foreign powers established their fortress, not in the city of Jerusalem, which is about an hour's walk away, not even, but outside the city. And the Assyrians at first, then the Babylonians, then the Persians. When the Hasmoneans conquer Jerusalem, they take this apart. And that's why very little has been found that's intact, because they say no more foreign powers in Jerusalem. That's it. We're kicking them out forever. Jewish sovereignty forever. Forever doesn't last so long, but they thought it will. Okay. The other site on the right is our same Nebi Samuel that we saw before, and where there was this beautiful residential neighborhood of Jews living by the late second century. Nobody's living there anymore. It's abandoned. And it's a little strange because Nebi Samuel is a nice place to live. It's a beautiful area. It's close to Jerusalem. It's got water. Why did they leave? And the suggestion is that they left because they no longer need to be sofeh to Jerusalem. They don't need to be looking out on Jerusalem. They can be in Jerusalem. And Hasmonean Jerusalem grows and more people come and live there. And we'll see that in a second. We're just going to do one last thing about the Maccabees themselves. And that's this question of the graves of the Maccabees. Where are the Maccabees buried? Okay. In the book of Maccabees, it says that when Judah dies, his brother Shimon creates a very elaborate family tomb with seven pyramids on top. Where is this tomb? Excellent question. Okay. In what we call today the forest of Ben Shemen, Yar Ben Shemen, there's an area that the Arabs used to call Kuber al Yehud, the burial place of the Jews. In 1907, the Gymnasia Herzliya in Tel Aviv decided that they wanted to go on a Hanukkah trip, a school trip, because it's Hanukkah. Now, remember that the Maccabees and Hanukkah, very, very important to early Zionism, right? These are the heroes of power. These are the Jews that are powerful Jews. They're not the weak diaspora ghetto Jews. They're the warriors, and we're going to be like them. So where, of course, are we going to go? We're going to go to the graves of the Maccabees. And they decide that this Kuber al Yehud is definitely the place, and they start to go there. 40 years later, there is a torch relay race that begins at the Maccabees graves. Kind of ironic, because that's like a very Greek thing, but that's what they did, right? And this has became accepted as the place of the Maccabees graves. Okay? There's even a memorial here for the soldiers who fell here in 1948, right? And connecting them to the story of the bravery of the Maccabees. Is it the real place? Maybe, right? Underneath this grave, we have found recently Beit Sheni, Second Temple period graves with ossuaries. So it's not impossible, but it doesn't look anything like what the Book of Maccabees says it looks like. Not far away from there is a site that is called Khirbet Hagardi, but it used to be called Sheikh Rawabi. Okay? Sheikh Rawabi was converted to become Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. This grave, which was an Arab, very important Arab's grave, has become now a Jewish grave. It's become a site that people come and visit and pray at. Is it the real thing? Probably not, but maybe. Again, graves, getting into very big trouble if you start talking about graves. Okay, what do the Hasmoneans do in Jerusalem? They expand the city up until in the end of the First Temple period, the city has grown. It shrinks again when the city is rebuilt in the Second Temple times. And only in Hasmonean times does it re-expand to include what we call today the Jewish Quarter and all the way to Jaffa Gate. And the Hasmoneans build a new wall. Okay, they build walls. They build residential neighborhoods. They build guard towers. This is by the Tower of David. This picture, which is just an amazing picture, it's a picture from below Mount Zion. And you can see in the excavation, you have this wall, which is the wall that the Byzantines build in the 5th century of the Common Era. Below it, where this young woman is standing, You have the Hasmonean Wall, which was built 700 years earlier in the exact same place. The Byzantines don't know about the Hasmonean Wall, but they built it in the same place. And further down, what you don't see in the picture is the remains of the first temple wall, Hezekiah's wall from 500 years earlier than that. So we keep finding bits and pieces of Hasmonean Jerusalem. The problem is that the person who comes along after the Hasmoneans, of course, is Herod. He builds so massively that he gets rid of a lot of what we would have known about from Hasmonean Jerusalem. So just to understand this, what are we talking about, right? Second Temple, early Second Temple Jerusalem is only this little strip here, but the Hasmoneans expand it all the way to the west to be a much larger city. Okay, so that's just to get a little bit of a sense of what we are talking about. Now, with a bigger city, you need more water. And they bring water. They're the first ones that start to bring aqueducts, water from outside the city, from the south, from the area near Beit Lechem, Solomon's Pools, Brechot Shlomo. This is a really nice mosaic map near the Hasmonean Aqueduct on the promenade in southern Jerusalem, bringing water to Jerusalem. We also have another aqueduct that's right near the Temple Mount. And they expand the city. Now, here you have the dynasty, right? Starting with Matityahu and going all the way to, we said, the last Hashmonaii ruler, Antigonos Matityahu, or Matityahu Antigonos. One of the things that's fascinating about this family tree is how the names of the Maccabees, which change from Yehuda and Shimon and Yohanan to Hyrcanus and Alexander and Aristobulus, the Maccabees themselves, or as their inheritors are called, the Hasmoneans, they become Hellenized, right? The anti-Hellenizers are becoming themselves very Hellenized, right? And it's really something that's it's a fascinating historical event, right? And as time passes, you have different rulers. John Hyrcanus and Alexander Yanai are the ones who expand the kingdom the most. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, the two brothers, are the ones with the civil war. And Herod comes in after Matityahu Antigonus is the last failed king. Just to understand the expansion, right? The original kingdom is just Judea, is very small, and each Hasmonean king conquers more and adds more, even on the other side of the Jordan. And one of the great conquerors is John Hyrcanus, and he conquers this area in the south, okay, which is settled by the Edomians, the Edomites, okay, that came in when the first temple is destroyed, conquer the south of Israel, move in, and they move into a bunch of different towns. One of them is Mareshah that we saw at the beginning. John Hyrcanus comes, conquers them, their territory, and he gives them a simple choice, a choice that we don't have very much in Jewish history, but we do have it here. And he says, you have a choice. You can either leave and leave me all your possessions and all your cities and everything, or you can convert. You can join us. You can become Jews and be our Baalei Brit, be our allies. Many Edomites choose to leave. Before they leave, they destroy their houses. And that's why there's a lot of very rich archaeology in Mareshah. But some Edomites decide if you can't beat them, join them. And they convert. And one of those Edomites is a fellow named Antipater, whose son is Herod. Okay, so the Hasmoneans are basically the ones who lead to Herod becoming king, which is a fascinating irony. In the house, one of the houses in Mareshah, they found coins from John Hyrcanus, telling us that this story fits with the timing. And as we said, the Hasmonean kings become wealthier, they become more Hellenized, they build incredible fortresses, many out in the Judean desert. This is from the palaces near Jericho. And as time passes, they become more and more like the kings that they had vanquished. And this is where we come to our last, second to last piece, which is what are some of the unintended consequences of this story, right? The Maccabees did not intend for these things to happen, but history is full of ironies. In the beginning, many people support Matityahu, support this fight, support this battle. Okay? And they want to kick out the Hellenizers and they want to retain Jewish Judaism, right? But they're not necessarily so keen on the whole idea of sovereignty, and certainly not on what the Maccabees do with it. Now, remember, who are the Maccabees? The Maccabees are Kohanim. Right? They are Kohanim, but they are not from the correct family to be Kohanim Gedolim. You need to be from the right family line. And they are definitely not from the right family to become kings. Who is a king in Jewish law? A king is from the house of David. The Maccabees are Levites. They don't belong in kingship, right? And yet they take for themselves both the kingdom and the Kehuna Gedolah and the high priesthood. And there are Jews who are very distressed by this. They say perhaps the temple is not really God's home anymore because the wrong people are ruling it. And they see the Hellenizing and they see the corruption. And they say these are warriors who have shed blood. They should not be in the temple at all. And some of them get so worked up that they pick themselves up. They leave Jerusalem. They go out to the Judean desert. And these are our friends who write the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? These are the guys of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we know that if it sounds far-fetched to you, we know that sectarianism, right? All these different groups, Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, begins around the time of the story of Hanukkah. We don't hear about it before that because there's a rift. There's a rift over the temple. There's the rift over the leadership. So that's one very unintended consequence, sectarianism. Another one, which we mentioned, Herod. Right? Herod's father is Antipater. He is an Edomian. He is converted and becomes at least kind of ethnically a Jew. And he, through a lot of street smarts and a lot of good politics, becomes very important to the Romans. And his son Herod is even smarter. And he establishes himself as king of the Jews. And he is the antithesis of anything the Hasmoneans would have wanted. He marries into the Hasmonean family. But he kills his wife. He kills his brother-in-law, who's the Kohen Gadol. He does a lot of good things for Judea. He makes the economy thrive. He does a lot of building. But in terms of his treatment of the rabbis and of Judaism, not so good. So that's a very unintended consequence. And the third and perhaps the most dire unintended consequence is bringing in the Romans. With the civil war, the general Pompey, that's this guy over here, is called in and the Romans don't leave. And the Romans establish control over the land of Israel for centuries upon centuries. And that is definitely not something that the Hasmoneans wanted to do. And I'll just finish up with two important points. Number one, as important as the Hasmonean revolt was, as important as that speech of Matityahu was, and I really do think that he saves Judaism, ultimately the Kohanim do not remain the religious leadership. Right? The Kohanim are supplanted by the rabbis. And the rabbis, of course, is a democracy of learning and of leadership because anybody can be a scholar. You have to be smart, but that's it, right? You don't even need to have been born a Jew. We hear about famous rabbis who are the descendants of converts. It's a much more democratic approach to Torah. You don't have to be from some special family. And even though Kohanim are still accorded a lot of honor in the Jewish world, they are not the natural leaders. And the place where this is most clearly said, it pops up everywhere, but it's very, very clear in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers, in the very, very first Mishnah. We have what's called the chain of tradition or transmission. Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, transmitted it to Joshua, Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. Who is not in the chain? Kohanim. There are no Kohanim here. Okay? Everybody is a scholar or a prophet. The Kohanim are left out completely. And in case you didn't get to the point, get to the last chapter of Pirkei Avot, where it's extremely explicit. Greater is learning Torah than the priesthood and then royalty. You might as well have just said then the Chashmonaim, right? Who is the priesthood? Who is royalty? The Chashmonaim. For royalty is acquired by 30 stages and the priesthood by 24, but the Torah by 48 things. So the rabbis supplant the Kohanim as the ultimate leadership. But the question of how much do we take from the outside culture? And today the outside culture is not Greek, but it is still an outside culture. And we are still always in this complicated dance of What can we take? What must we reject? What can enrich Judaism? What is bad for Judaism? And even the most ultra of the ultra Orthodox, the most Haredi of the Haredim, is also dealing with this conflict. And I brought you an example here of two Hanukkah songs, which I think show the two poles here, right? One, of course, is Ma'oz Tzur that we are all familiar with. And the hero of Ma'oz Tzur is the Tzur, right? Hatzur Tamim Po'alo is God. God is the one who is our Yeshua, who is our Savior. And he is the one that we pray to that at the end of days, Chasof Zroa Kodshecha, the Karev Keta Yeshua, bring the redemption. Contrast that with the modern Zionist song, which is a beautiful song, of Miyamalel, right? Miyamalel, what is Miyamalel? Miyamalel Gvurot Yisrael. Who shall sing of the glories of Israel? Bechol Dor Yakum HaGibor Goel Ha'am. Every generation will have a warrior who will redeem the people.
Second door.
People will redeem themselves. There is no God. Right? It is all in the hands of the people. And that's a very early Zionist approach. And to some people still today, a very strong Zionist approach. So those are the two poles. And we have to sort of find our way somewhere in the middle. And I will let the last word go to the great scholar of Second Temple Judaism, Professor Elias Bickerman, Ezra Bickerman. And this is what he says. Contact with the enlightened and universal culture of Hellenism could only be salutary for one who, wrestling as Jacob did with the angel, did not allow himself to be overcome, but extorted its blessing, not losing himself in Hellenism, but coming safely away with enhanced strength. Only two people of antiquity succeeded in doing so, the Romans and the Jews. The Romans succeeded because they became the rulers even of the Hellenic world. To be sure, they lost much in the process, a good part of their national religion, for instance, whose gods Greek gods supplanted. The Jews succeeded because their knowledge of the oneness of God and of his worldview, in a word, the singular character of their faith, set up an inner barrier against surrender and separated them from the rest of the world. So let us stop sharing. Let us see what these many questions are. So many questions. Let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
See what they are. I love
While you, Shuli, while you read the questions, first of all, thank you. I just want to make a little announcement for those who weren't online yesterday, even if you were online yesterday. Coming to the end of the year, we would like to ask people to help donate, just to help support the programs we're doing, all the classes we're doing. We're trying to raise between now and the end of the year $50,000 to support these classes. This is the 284th class. Shuli has the 284th class, five of them given by Shuli. We've had over 25,000 hours of people coming to the classes, 70 teachers. We've had over 100,000 downloads of our MP3s. And Imen Kemach Ein Torah. This does cost money to run. And we don't charge for all these classes, as you know. And many people have been kind to donate. I'm asking you to help us so we can continue, we can expand, to consider sponsoring a class, a Zoom class, to consider sponsoring a day of learning. I put the link to donate in the chat box. You can click on the link and donate now. And thank you very much for it. We enjoy having you. It's a pleasure to learn with all of you. And we look forward to continue your learning. And through your support, we can continue to grow what we're doing. Thank you very much. Okay, Shuli, I hope you had a chance to read all the questions.
Thank you. A lot of them are comments, which everybody can just read for themselves. I'm just going to address if there are questions, right? One is, why build a mikveh except where people live? Okay, very important to build a mikveh on the road because you have these tons and tons of people who are going on pilgrimage to Jerusalem and they want to be pure before they get to Jerusalem. So that makes a lot of sense to have a mikveh. Also, because when you think of a mikveh, don't think only of how we use the mikveh today, which for most people is married women going to the mikveh, right? But the mikveh in those days was to be pure to go into the temple as well. Right? Are the Hashmonaim fighting Greeks only or Greek and Hellenized Jews? It seems from the books that there is also battle against the Hellenized Jews, although we really hear much more about the military battles, but presumably the Hellenized Jews, the ones who are really extreme Hellenizers, probably are joining on the Greek side. And some of them who are sitting on the fence anyway, are going to go with the winning side. Processing oil and wine impurity for the temple. Yes. Emmaus is met. Yes, Emmaus is very important to Christianity. That's a separate story, but where Jesus comes back to life and he is seen after he is buried. Okay, overlap of Shiurim, pilgrims on the way to Jerusalem, right? The 24th. I think it says the 24th, and then something happens the next, like it's the day before. I have to go back and look at it again.
Yesterday. That was Rabbi Liptak's topic yesterday on Chagai.
So did he say 24 or 25?
First of all, I said the 24th of night is the 25th and how it counted. And right, he discussed that issue a little bit. Everybody can listen on the on Rabbi Liptak's talk from
Nice. Okay.
That's what I meant by the overlap of Shiurim. That's what I was referring
that's
to.
That's always nice.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
When you say the same thing, but me and Rabbi Liebtag are not saying the same thing, so you don't have to worry.
No, you.
Yes, 10 years ago, Christopher Hitchens wrote a fairly well-known essay that the Jews' victory over the Greeks was one of the world's greatest tragedies, leading to three monotheistic religions. Well, that's Christopher Hitchens, right? That's true. By the same token, it tells us how important the victory of Hanukkah was to us. That is a nice way of putting it. Thank you, Hannah Weisler. Thank you, everyone. Happy Hanukkah. Compare with some of the challenges faced by Israel today. Ask Rabbi Kalman to bring in Natan Sharansky, and he will, or someone else who will speak. But it's true. Look, Israel today is also walking that tightrope all the time. We do have extremes on both sides, but most people are trying to figure out a middle way, right? That we want to be part of the family of nations. We are proud of being part of the family of nations. And yet we retain our Jewish uniqueness and our Jewish message and our Or LaGoyim. And we are always trying to have it both ways. And that's not a simple thing, but it's the challenge. It's the ultimate challenge of modern Orthodoxy, I think.
The ultimate challenge of all Jews in the modern world. Each, as you said, even the most Haredi of the Haredim deals with that in a different way than we do, but everybody's dealing with
that. Everybody deals with it. You cannot close yourself off from the modern world.
100%. Anyways, thank you again for a fascinating share. We look forward to learning with you.